You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
First came the earthquake. Immediately after came the highly publicized international response, promising massive assistance for reconstruction. This was Haiti, 1 year and a half ago. So what are the living conditions for the people now? A three-person Canadian fact-finding delegation went to Haiti near the end of June to find the answers to this question. Roger Annis was a member of the delegation, and he has just recently returned to BC. Roger Annis is a retired aerospace worker and coordinator of Haiti Solidarity BC and the Canada-Haiti Action Network. Welcome back to Red Eye, Roger.
Oh, thanks. It's good to be with you.
Briefly, can you first give us an overview of the present situation there in Haiti?
Sure. We were there for 10 days, and we traveled throughout the earthquake zone. We saw lots of signs of people hard at work, Haitians, as well as their international friends and supporters. A lot of rubble's been cleared from the streets, so traffic moves, though it's very congested, and you see lots of signs on a small scale of people rebuilding, but I'm afraid our overall impression was not the best. We didn't really see the evidence of a robust rebuilding effort for the country, and certainly that's what the Haitians that we met with throughout the earthquake zone told us, and they expressed their great frustration over all of this.
Given the extreme housing situation and the absence of rebuilding, as you noted, what desperate alternatives are Haitians choosing?
Well, in some cases, they are pretty desperate. The estimates for the number of people still living in makeshift camps is more than 600,000 people. Those are the best counts by the UN and some other international agencies. You see it throughout the city. Some of the camps are quite large. The largest one, Camp Jean-Marie Vincent, is still houses about 40 or 50,000 people. And some of them can be as few as a few dozen families on a street corner. You see them throughout throughout the city. And life and conditions there are extremely rough. Many of the camps will have a bare minimum of services, such as drinking water, some food provision. But the tropical sun's very hot. People are living under tarps or under scraps of plastic or metal. Job prospects are very few. Some of the camps will have a reasonably good access to medical service, but many of them don't. And the public health system in Haiti itself is really going through now, you'd almost say a regression now happening, as some of the resources that came into the country have begun to dry up. So very harsh conditions in the camps. And also there was a pre-existing housing crisis in Haiti, a very deep one, and you're really seeing that come forward as well. And I would say a certain reluctance on the part of the international organizations that are there and the international governments to face up to that reality, because you have tens of thousands of people that are moving on to what were previously barren lands just on the very northern extreme limit of Port-au-Prince. And so this has added a whole new dimension to the housing crisis. You've got to have informal camps with tens of thousands of people in them now who rightfully expect services, but for whom nothing at all is being delivered. These are not even the sort of formal camps. These are just resettlements that are happening under the impact of the housing and crisis in Haiti. So really an added dimension to the to the earthquake crisis itself.
You mentioned the informal camps. Is there any health care there or outside in the more formal camps as well?
Well, in the formal camps, there may or may not be access to health service. I mentioned Camp Jean-Marie Vincent, Partners in Health, is providing services there. Doctors Without Borders is active in some camps, some of the International Red Cross agencies and so on. So it's uneven. But in the informal settlements, and I wouldn't call them camps, these are sort of newly arisen as people scramble to resolve their housing crisis, there's nothing at all. The international organizations are reluctant to go into the informal settlements, and in fact they've been instructed not to do so by the Haitian government and also by the UN agencies. But these informal camps are a testament to the failure to mobilize resources to begin to tackle the housing crisis. Nobody thinks that in Haiti today that the people affected by the earthquake can be resettled within months. It's going to take it's going to take years of work. But what the Haitian people want to see is a plan. They want to see a national government with backing internationally that has a plan and that's mobilizing resources and that's taking the tough decisions to get housing built. And this is the biggest disappointment at all, is not seeing that. And this is one of the consequences of the chronic political crisis that the electoral process that the country was forced to go through has produced. So that's it. There's tremendous frustration over the delay in all this, and people's patience is running out on this.
And where is the Canadian money going in Haiti?
Well, there's most of the donations the Canadians gave went to the Red Cross. So the Canadian Red Cross has built some temporary shelters. They have worked with other National Red Crosses in shelter building programs. There's been delivery of water and other services. The Canadian Red Cross has been involved in cholera treatment centers. And then of course the larger agencies such as World Vision and Oxfam and lots of others we could name have been there assisting with temporary shelter or assisting with temporary medical needs. But this is, this is not the rebuilding of a national government and of robust national agencies, a Ministry of Health, for example, or a Ministry of Education, all the things that are needed to deliver basic social services to the Haitian people. And so that's what we're not seeing. It's as far as how much of the funds have been delivered, the overall figures show that of the several billions of dollars that were pledged by international governments and agencies to Haiti, about 35% has been delivered in the past year and a half, and the rate of delivery of the funds is slowing down more and more. So probably half of the money that Canadians donated to Haiti has been delivered in some form or another to date, and hopefully we'll see the other half of the money continue to flow. But accounting on all this is not the best, and the record on the ground in Haiti is a very mixed one. People are working very hard to assist the Haitian people in getting things accomplished. But the root of the problem in Haiti is the absence of robust national government, of sovereignty, we'll use that word, a robust government with resources to tackle all of the social problems confronting the Haitian people. And I think on that front, we're not really any closer today than we were at the time of the earthquake to resolving that. This, of course, is an existing problem in Haiti, but it's felt much, much more acutely today.
Well, you've spoken about the national government. How would you characterize the approach of the new Haitian president, Michel Martelly?
Well, I think it's a failed approach. Mr. Martelly is the president as a result of a electoral process that began last year that was essentially pushed upon the country by the big foreign governments of the world, including Canada. Canada, the U.S., and Europe financed the election process that the Haitian people went through. The people didn't go through, the institutions went through. Less than a quarter of the Haitian people took part in the vote, among other reasons because the most representative political party in Haiti, which is the Famille Lavalasse, a former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was formally excluded from participation in the election. Just unbelievable that an election could be held under those conditions. It'd be like having an election in Canada and the Supreme Court ordering the Liberal Party off the ballot or something. It was a completely unrepresentative election, but the big powers wanted their man, shall we say, in the president's chair. So this was not a representative election for the population, and we're seeing the results today. Mr. Martelly has been, ever since the conclusion of the election in late March, his first act as a president has to be to appoint a prime minister who can then form a cabinet and a government, and things can get underway. And we're more than 4 months now since the end of the election, and still no cabinet, because Mr. Martelly wants one of his right-wing cronies as prime minister of the country, and twice now the Senate has refused to ratify that nomination. That's the process in Haiti. The Senate, as well as the legislature, has to approve the president's nominee for prime minister. And so two of Martelly's nominations now have been refused. So the country's in a state of political paralysis. And so Mr. Martelly has put his partisan and right-wing political interests ahead of the needs of reconstruction. And we're now, as a result of the rejection of the second nominee, we're still months away from seeing a government formed in Haiti. This bears down very, very heavily on the situation, and sadly is a legacy of the a continuation of the politics of intervention that have marked Haiti for more than 10 years now.
What about reconstruction in the rural areas? We hear far more about urban Haiti than rural Haiti. In your delegation, I understand, met with representatives of Haiti's largest peasant organization. What did they tell you?
Yes, we met with the Tête Collée Petit Paysan Haïtien, it's called, which is one of four large peasant organizations in Haiti. They told us that despite all of the goodwill and promises voiced at the time of the earthquake, that they have essentially been shut out of the reconstruction process in Haiti. Tête Collée has an office in Port-au-Prince because you have to be close to the government offices if you're going to try and have your voice heard, but they're not being consulted in any substantive way. That's what they told us. We're not, pulling that out of press reports or something. We sat down with them for a couple of hours, and yet, when the future of Haiti was being discussed following the earthquake, everyone recognized that one of the things that's gone wrong in Haiti is that Haiti's agricultural economy has been, I would say, subverted by the trade practices of the large agricultural countries of the world, in particular the United States. That this legacy of destruction, and that's the word one has to use, destruction of Haiti's food-producing capacity, has to be turned around and repaired. Instead of foisting on Haiti subsidized food imports in the form of either charity aid or other programs, that Haiti needs to have a robust food producing capacity, food sovereignty, as it's popularly called. And certainly Haitian peasants are fighting for this. During our time in Haiti, there was a large protest that happened in the town of Hanche, which is a couple of hours' drive north of Port-au-Prince. Several tens of thousands of peasants rallying for the basic principles of food sovereignty and food self-sufficiency. So there's the will and desire there on the part of the Haitian people, but they're not being listened to. And really, it's the same old failed economic model that has come from the big powers of the world in the past that is really being just reborn anew in Haiti. But there will be resistance to this. There is resistance to this on the part of the Haitian people. They will fight for a different kind of future for the country, and that's a tough battle because there's so much to be done in the aftermath of the earthquake.
What could Canadians do, or the Canadian government do, to improve that approach to the situation in Haiti?
Well, I think the first thing is they should listen to the Haitian people. Our delegation wrote a report of our findings. It's a modest contribution. There's been much more substantial reports written of late. Listeners can go to the website of the Canada-Haiti Action Network and look under the section called Human Rights Reports, and you'll see there a whole range of very substantial reports looking at the needs in Haiti and what's required to create a more robust rebuilding effort. So the Canadian government has to listen to the Haitian people and has to listen to the serious international organizations. Members of the Canadian Parliament do very well to read Paul Farmer's new book. It's just been published. It's called Haiti After the Earthquake, and it looks at the challenges faced by Haiti today in the historical context. It's, I think, a very good book for people to gain an understanding of what's happening there. So our report, among its recommendations, is asking the members of the Canadian Parliament spend more time and energy looking at the situation in Haiti and coming up with different policies for Canada, because unfortunately Canada's the policies of the Canadian government have been one of simply trying to reinforce all of the failed model of political and economic intervention into Haiti. So that has to change. Canadian organizations can establish working relations with their counterparts in Haiti. That could be at the level of delivery of healthcare services or defending and upholding human rights. Lawyers in Canada could play a very effective role. We saw very good examples in Haiti of international assistance at the level of human rights that were really making a difference to the lives of people in the camps as they get organized to fight for their rights. Trade unions and farmer organizations in Canada can make contributions. This is not going to turn around the situation in Haiti. Haiti needs very substantial assistance from the wealthy governments of the world, but it needs to come in a form that's respecting Haiti's sovereignty, that's building robust national institutions. And so that's our main message to the Canadian government, is the Canadian government should be involved in helping Haiti to create robust and effective national and public institutions. But presently, Canada's part of the problem in Haiti. So this kind of change in policy will only come about as Canadians become more informed of the situation in Haiti and then press their views upon our elected representatives in Ottawa so that we can see these changes over time.
Well, thanks, Roger, for joining us today and for staying on top of the situation down there in Haiti.
Sure. I wish I could deliver a more positive picture for your listeners, but I will stress that, you know, the Haitian people are trying to deal with this situation, and they're looking for international allies in doing so, and so that's that was the spirit of our visit, and certainly the spirit of what we deliver upon coming back. There's a big job of solidarity ahead of us now, and we encourage everyone in Canada to become engaged in that.
Thanks again. I've been speaking with Roger Annis. Roger is a retired aerospace worker and coordinator of Haiti Solidarity BC and the Canada-Haiti Action Network. To read the complete report of the Haiti fact-finding delegation, you can go to the Red Eye site, where you can find a link. The Red Eye site can be found at vcn.bc.ca/redeye. Roger will also be speaking on the fact-finding delegation's observations at a public meeting. That meeting will take place Wednesday, August 17th, 7 p.m. at the Mount Pleasant Community Center, and that community center is number 1 Kingsway near Main Street.